The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about testosterone's bad reputation. This is the hormone typically associated with aggressive behavior.
Well, that's what's thought, Rob. I mean, men tend to have more testosterone and men tend to be more aggressive. And so the common wisdom is that testosterone is one of these hormones that makes us more aggressive, more competitive, more self-serving, more antisocial is how researchers define the term.
So now the uncommon wisdom.
Now the uncommon wisdom, which is argued by the group of researchers in this study, is that testosterone is really more about maintaining social hierarchies. And what they mean by that is they think it sort of almost has the opposite effect. It makes us play fair with each other so that we sort of maintain our social cohesion, social hierarchies, helps us know how to treat people. A side effect of that is, you know, when we're competing in our social hierarchies, we can tend to get aggressive, which would actually not be a result of testosterone. It would be something completely unrelated, but it could be why testosterone is often associated with these negative connotations. But, you know, this is a theory the researchers had. They wanted to find a way to test this, and that's what this study is all about.
So how'd they go about it?
They played an economic game with a group of young women.
Why women?
Well, women have a lower baseline level of testosterone, and the pharmacokinetics, as they say, of testosterone is actually much more well understood in women than it is in men, and so researchers sort of had a better model to work with women. So what the researchers did was they took these women, they took about 60 women, and they had them play this economic game on a computer. And these women were given 10 Swiss francs, and they were told, you have a partner, and you can decide how evenly you want to split that money with your partner. If your partner likes the division that you've proposed, then you'll both get the money. But if your partner doesn't like the division that you proposed, in other words, if she thinks you've proposed something very unfair, then neither of you get the money. And so the basic idea of the study is to test how fair these women would act. I mean, it makes sense if you're being really fair. You're going to say, well, let's split it. 5 francs, 5 francs, or 50-50. That seems like a fair split. And chances are the partner player is going to agree with that and everybody goes home happy. But if you're being very sort of aggressive or being very unfair, you might propose a very unfair split and then both of you would lose out on the money if the partner rejects the offer. And so the researchers played this game, and the twist they added with testosterone was that some women got a dose of testosterone and some women got a placebo, and they didn't know which one they were getting. They were just given something under their tongue. And what the researchers noticed was that their theory seems to be correct. The women that were under the influence of testosterone were actually a lot more fair. Women that were on testosterone proposed giving their partner an average of about 3.9 francs, which is almost a 50-50 split, versus 3.4 francs on the women that were on placebo. So this was some nice baseline evidence that testosterone actually makes us more fair, not more antisocial. But the really interesting results came next because the women didn't know whether they had gotten testosterone or whether they got the placebo. And so after the experiments ended, the researchers conducted a survey and they said, what do you think we gave you? Do you think we gave you testosterone or do you think we gave you a placebo? And what was really interesting is that the women who thought they were given testosterone but were actually given a placebo were actually much more antisocial than the women who thought that they were given a placebo, but were actually given testosterone.
So they were the most unfair when they thought they had gotten testosterone.
Exactly. And what that says to the researchers is that all of our negative associations with testosterone, that it makes us antisocial and more aggressive and less fair, actually has a very profound impact on how we behave. If we think we're on testosterone, we're going to behave like society says we should behave if we're on testosterone. But that's not actually what testosterone is doing. If you look at the data, what testosterone is doing is almost the opposite. It's making us more fair and more social.
Keeping the status, as it were, status quo.
Exactly.
Okay. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, this is another story that has to do with the sexes, but not the sexes in humans, but the sexes in flies. This is a story about how female flies can be too attractive for their species.
How so?
Well, let's start with what makes an attractive fly. It turns out that the bigger the female, the more attractive she is. And the thinking goes is because bigger females have more resources for her offspring and actually even more room for eggs. And so if a male really wants to increase the number of offspring it has, it's going to go for these bigger females. And that's actually what researchers see. If they put, you know, a bunch of males in a vial with females of various sizes, the males tend to congregate mostly around these bigger females. But, you know, the males are very disruptive when they congregate around females. They perform these mating dances where they're flying around and buzzing their wings. You can actually see a video of this on the site. And they generally just really harass the female, so much so that she actually has a hard time eating because she's surrounded by so many males. And the researchers said, that can't be good for the females. I wonder what the effect of all this male harassment is. And what they did was they looked at how many eggs these large females lay when they're harassed by males versus when they're not harassed by males. And they found that the females lay significantly fewer eggs when they're harassed by males than when they're left alone.
Do the bigger females still lay more eggs than the smaller females on average?
They do. And so that's the real conundrum here, because on the one hand, females can be too attractive for their species. And what's meant by that is if females are so big and that's causing a lot of males to congregate around them, and the females are laying less eggs as a result, and these eggs, which ostensibly for genetic reasons, become larger females in the long run, then the long-run effect of this male behavior is that it's causing fewer large females to be born, and that's going to be bad for the species in the long run because these bigger females lay more eggs and have more resources. But from the male's perspective, it still makes sense. You know, the males really aren't thinking about the species. They're thinking about themselves.
Assuming they're even thinking at all, right?
Well, assuming they're thinking, it's how much a fruit fly thinks. But what they're, you know, from their perspective, they're still going to get more offspring from these larger females because even when harassed, these larger females lay about 4 more eggs on average than smaller females. So it's still to the male's advantage to go after these big females, even though from the species perspective, it may not be a good idea.
So in a sense, with this behavior, the males are selecting against a trait that's beneficial for their species.
Yeah, and it shows that evolution doesn't always lead to something that's better for the species. At least that's what one expert says.
Does it make a difference that these were all captive flies? I mean, does this kind of crowding behavior of females happen when they're not all trapped together?
Well, that's a good question, Rob, and one I don't know the answer to.
Okay. So last story then. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, we started at humans. We went to flies. Let's end up on monkeys. This last story is all about how monkeys might be using a form of human grammar.
Nouns, verb, adjectives, adverbs, what?
Well, we're talking about suffixes. Researchers in this study found that monkeys seem to add an extra sound, and it's always the same sound, to the end of some of their common calls to change the meaning of the calls, just like we might add a couple extra letters to the end of a word to change the meaning of a word.
What's an example?
Well, let's take a couple. First, listen to this call. Now, that's a call monkeys use to warn their comrades that an eagle is approaching. Now, listen to this call.
It's sort of like the first one, but yeah, I hear the suffix, there's ooh sound.
Exactly. There's this ooh sound at the end. Now let's try a different call. Listen to this call. Now that's a warning. These monkeys, and these are what are called Campbell's monkeys. They have these actually almost like old man faces and a tuft of orange on the top of their head. You can see a picture of them with the story. So that's a call these monkeys use when a leopard is approaching. So a different warning call for a different predator. Now listen to this call.
Again, the ooh.
Again, the ooh. And so what the team found is they found a number of calls like this where there was one call that they knew the monkeys used for something, but then they heard that call again in a different context with this ooh sound in it. And they made a bunch of recordings. They followed these monkeys around, and they discovered for that first call we heard, the hawk call, which is by itself is for eagles, when the monkeys add the ooh to the end of it, it became this sort of general alert for a disturbance somewhere in the tree canopy, you know, maybe a branch falling or something like that. And with that second call, we heard the so-called crack call, which is for leopards. When an ooh is added to the end of that, that could be almost any disturbance. So any kind of something that happens in the forest, monkeys might use that crack ooh call.
Does the ooh sound mean anything by itself? Like don't take this as seriously?
Well, that's the big question. I mean, if this is really sort of a suffix, as researchers are proposing, then this oo sound, you know, should be sort of consistent. It should mean something. It should sort of maybe always change these words in the same way. And it doesn't exactly seem like that's happening. It seems like it's a nice way for the monkeys, instead of having to invent a brand new call, just to modify some of their other calls to really increase what the researchers call their vocal repertoire. You know, these monkeys live in these dense forests. They often can't see each other. And so they really have to have a lot of different calls for a number of different situations, you know, and rather than inventing 10 calls, why not just take 5 calls and add this suffix to them to change the call? But it's really still, the jury's really still out about whether the monkeys are actually using this as sort of a grammar suffix the way we do, or whether it's just sort of an interesting sound they found that if they add to the end of their call, it changes the meaning of the call. And to really find that out, the researchers are going to have to do a lot more studies with this to figure out not only how monkeys make these calls, but how other monkeys respond to these calls. And that's really going to also determine how these oo sounds are really being used.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about blocking fear memories in humans and also a story about why dogs are such good sniffers, why their sense of smell is so much superior to that of humans. And for Science Insider, the science policy blog, we're following the Copenhagen climate talks that are occurring for the next couple of weeks, and we've got daily coverage about that meeting in addition to all of the other policy stories we're running. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.